disgusted. I don't see how I can stand it. I feel like doing all kinds of crazy things just for the heck of it. Things that might even be bad for me. Jim blew a smoke ring expertly. And then, said Helmholtz, he snapped his fingers and honked his horn. And then, Jim, I remember I've got at least one tiny corner of the universe I can make just the way I want it. I can go to it and gloat over it until I'm brand new and happy again.
Aren't you the lucky one? Said Jim. He yawned.
I am, for a fact, said Helmholtz. My corner of the universe happens to be in the air around my band. I can fill it with music. Mr. Beeler in zoology has his butterflies. Mr. Trotman in physics has his pendulum and tuning forks. Making sure everybody has a corner like that is about the biggest job we teachers have.
The car door opened and slammed, and Jim was gone. Helmholtz stamped out Jim's cigarette and buried it under the gravel of the parking lot. Helmholtz's first class of the morning was C band, where beginners thumped and wheezed and tooted as best they could and looked down the long, long, long road through to B band, to A band, the Lincoln High School 10-square band, the finest band in the world. Helmholtz stepped onto the podium and raised his baton.
You are better than you think, he said. A one, a two, a three.
Down came the baton. C band set out in its quest for beauty, set out like a rusty switch engine with valves stuck, pipes clogged, unions leaking, bearings dry. Helmholtz was still smiling at the end of the hour because he'd heard in his mind the music as it was going to be someday. His throat was raw, for he had been singing with the band for the whole hour. He stepped into the hall for a drink from the fountain. As he drank, he heard the jingling of chains. He looked up at Jim Donini. Rivers of students flowed between classrooms, pausing in friendly eddies, flowing on again. Jim was alone. When he paused, it wasn't to greet anyone, but to polish the toes of his boots on his trouser legs. He had the air of a spy in a melodrama, missing nothing, liking nothing, looking forward to the great day when everything would be turned upside down.
Hello, Jim, said Helmholtz. Say, I was just thinking about you. We've got a lot of clubs and teams that meet after school, and that's a good way to get to know a lot of people.
Jim measured Helmholtz carefully with his eyes.
Maybe I don't want to know a lot of people, he said. Ever think of that?
He set his feet down hard to make his chains jingle as he walked away. When Helmholtz returned to the podium for a rehearsal of B band, there was a note waiting for him, calling him to a special faculty meeting. The meeting was about vandalism. Someone had broken into the school and wrecked the office of Mr. Crane, head of the English department. The poor man's treasures, books, diplomas, snapshots of England, the beginnings of 11 novels, had been ripped and crumpled, mixed, dumped, and trampled and drenched with ink. Helmholtz was sickened. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't bring himself to think about it. It didn't become real to him until late that night in a dream. In the dream, Helmholtz saw a boy with barracuda teeth, with claws like baling hooks. The monster climbed into a window of the high school and dropped to the floor of the band rehearsal room. The monster clawed to shreds the heads of the biggest drum in the state. Helmholtz woke up howling. There was nothing to do but to dress and go to the school. At 2 in the morning, Helmholtz caressed the drum heads in the band rehearsal room with the night watchman looking on. He rolled the drum back and forth on its cart, and he turned the light inside, on and off, on and off. The drum was unharmed. The night watchman left to make his rounds. The band's treasure house was safe. With the contentment of a miser counting his money, Helmholtz fondled the rest of the instruments one by one, and then he began to polish the sousaphones. As he polished, he could hear the great horns roaring, could see them flashing in the sunlight with the stars and stripes and the banner of Lincoln High going before.
Yum, yum, teedle, teedle, yum, yum, teedle, teedle,
sang Helmholtz happily.
Yum, 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 rah, yum, 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 boom.
As he paused to choose the next number for his imaginary band to play, he heard a furtive noise in the chemistry laboratory next door.
Helmholtz sneaked into the hall, jerked open the laboratory door, and flashed on the lights. Jim Danini had a bottle of acid in either hand. He was splashing acid over the periodic table of the elements, over the blackboards covered with formulas, over the bust of Lavoisier. The scene was the most repulsive thing Helmholtz could have looked upon. Jim smiled with thin bravado.
"Get out," said Helmholtz.
"What are you going to do?" said Jim.
"Clean up. Save what I can,"
said Helmholtz dazedly. He picked up a wad of cotton waste and began wiping up the acid. "You going to call the cops?" said Jim.
I don't know," said Helmholtz. "No thoughts come. If I'd caught you hurting the bass drum, I think I would have killed you with a single blow. But I wouldn't have had any intelligent thoughts about what you thought you were doing."
"It's about time this place got set on its ear," said Jim.
"Is it?"
said Helmholtz. "That must be so if one of our students wants to murder it."
"What good is it?"
said Jim.
"Not much good, I guess," said Helmholtz. "It's just the best thing human beings ever managed to do."
He was helpless, talking to himself. He had a bag of tricks for making boys behave like men, tricks that played on boyish fears and dreams and loves. But here was a boy without fear, without dreams, without love.
"If you smashed up all the schools," said Helmholtz, "we wouldn't have any hope left."
"What hope?" said Jim.
"The hope that everybody will be glad he's alive," said Helmholtz, "even you."
"That's a laugh," said Jim.
"All I ever got out of this dump was a hard time. So what are you going to do?"
"I have to do something, don't I?" said Helmholtz.
"I don't care what you do," said Jim.
"I know," said Helmholtz. "I know."
He marched Jim into his tiny office off the band rehearsal room. He dialed the telephone number of the principal's home. Numbly, he waited for the bell to get the old man from his bed. Jim dusted his boots with a rag. Helmholtz suddenly dropped the telephone into its cradle before the principal could answer.
"Isn't there anything you care about but ripping, hacking, bending, rending, smashing, bashing?" he cried. "Anything? Anything but those boots?"
"Go on, call up whoever you're going to call," said Jim.
Helmholtz opened a locker and took a trumpet from it. He thrust the trumpet into Jim's arms.
"There,"
he said, puffing with emotion.
"There's my treasure. It's the dearest thing I own. I give it to you to smash. I won't move a muscle to stop you. You can have the added pleasure of watching my heart break while you do it."
Jim looked at him oddly. He laid down the trumpet.
"Go on," said Helmholtz. "If the world has treated you so badly, it deserves to have the trumpet smashed."
"I,"
said Jim. Helmholtz grabbed his belt, put a foot behind him, and dumped him on the floor. Helmholtz pulled Jim's boots off and threw them into a corner.
"There,"
said Helmholtz savagely. He jerked the boy to his feet again and thrust the trumpet into his arms once more. Jim Danini was barefoot now. He had lost his socks with his boots. The boy looked down. The feet that had once seemed big black clubs were narrow as chicken wings now, bony and blue and not quite clean. The boy shivered, then quaked. Each quake seemed to shake something loose inside until, at last, there was no boy left. No boy at all. Jim's head lolled as though he waited only for death. Helmholtz was overwhelmed by remorse. He threw his arms around the boy.
Jim, listen to me, boy.
Jim stopped quaking.
"You know what you've got there, the trumpet," said Helmholtz. "You know what's special about it?"
Jim only sighed.
"It belonged to John Philip Sousa,"
said Helmholtz. He rocked and shook Jim gently, trying to bring him back to life.
"I'll trade it to you, Jim, for your boots. It's yours, Jim. John Philip Sousa's trumpet is yours. It's worth hundreds of dollars, Jim, thousands."
Jim laid his head on Helmholtz's breast.
"It's better than boots, Jim," said Helmholtz.
You can learn to play it. You're somebody, Jim. You're the boy with John Philip Sousa's trumpet.
Helmholtz released Jim slowly, sure the boy would topple. Jim didn't fall. He stood alone. The trumpet was still in his arms.
I'll take you home, Jim, said Helmholtz. Be a good boy, and I won't say a word about tonight. Polish your trumpet and learn to be a good boy.
Can I have my boots? Said Jim dully.
No, said Helmholtz. I don't think they're good for you.
He drove Jim home. He opened the car windows and the air seemed to refresh the boy. He let him out at Quinn's restaurant. The soft pats of Jim's bare feet on the sidewalk echoed down the empty street. He climbed through a window and into his bedroom behind the kitchen, and all was still. The next morning, the waddling, clanking, muddy machines were making the vision of Bert Quinn come true. They were smoothing off the place where the hill had been behind the restaurant. They were making it as level as a billiard table. Helmholtz sat in a booth again. Quinn joined him again. Jim mopped again. Jim kept his eyes down, refusing to notice Helmholtz. And he didn't seem to care when a surf of suds broke over the toes of his small and narrow brown Oxfords.
Eating out two mornings in a row? Said Quinn. Something wrong at home?
My wife's still out of town, said Helmholtz.
While the cat's away, said Quinn. He winked.
When the cat's away, said Helmholtz, this mouse gets lonesome. Quinn leaned forward.
Is that what got you out of bed in the middle of the night, Helmholtz? Loneliness?
He jerked his head at Jim.
Kid, go get Mr. Helmholtz's horn.
Jim raised his head, and Helmholtz saw that his eyes were oyster-like again. He marched away to get the trumpet. Quinn now showed that he was excited and angry.
You take away his boots, and you give him a horn, and I'm not supposed to get curious, he said. I'm not supposed to start asking questions. I'm not supposed to find out you caught him taking the school apart. You'd make a lousy crook, Helmholtz. You'd leave your baton, sheet music, and your driver's license at the scene of the crime.
I don't think about hiding clues, said Helmholtz. I just do what I do. I was going to tell you.
Quinn's feet danced and his shoes squeaked like mice.
Yes, he said. Well, I've got some news for you, too.
What is that? Said Helmholtz uneasily.
It's all over with Jim and me, said Quinn. Last night was a payoff. I'm sending him back where he came from.
To another string of foster homes? Said Helmholtz weakly.
Whatever the experts figure out to do with a kid like that.
Quinn sat back, exhaled noisily, and went limp with relief.
You can't, said Helmholtz.
I can,
said Quinn.
That will be the end of him, said Helmholtz. He can't stand to be thrown away like that one more time.
He can't feel anything, said Quinn. I can't help him. I can't hurt him. Nobody can. There isn't a nerve in him.
A bundle of scar tissue, said Helmholtz.
The bundle of scar tissue returned with the trumpet. Impassively, he laid it on the table in front of Helmholtz. Helmholtz forced a smile.
It's yours, Jim, he said. I gave it to you.
Take it while you got the chance, Helmholtz, said Quinn. He doesn't want it. All he'll do is swap it for a knife or a pack of cigarettes.
He doesn't know what it is yet, said Helmholtz. It takes a while to find out.
Is it any good?
Said Quinn.
Any good?
Said Helmholtz, not believing his ears. Any good?
He didn't see how anyone could look at the instrument and not be warmed and dazzled by it.
Any good?
He murmured.
It belonged to John Philip Sousa. Quinn blinked stupidly.
Who?
Helmholtz's hands fluttered on the tabletop like the wings of a dying bird.
Who was John Philip Sousa? He piped.
No words came. The subject was too big for a tired man to cover. The dying bird expired and lay still. After a long silence, Helmholtz picked up the trumpet. He kissed the cold mouthpiece and pumped the valves in a dream of a brilliant cadenza.
Over the bell of the instrument, Helmholtz saw Jim Donini's face, seemingly floating in space, all but deaf and blind. Now Helmholtz saw the futility of men and their treasures. He had thought that his greatest treasure, the trumpet, could buy a soul for Jim. The trumpet was worthless. Deliberately, Helmholtz hammered the trumpet against the table edge. He bent it around a coat tree. He handed the wreck to Quinn.
"You busted it," said Quinn, amazed. "Why'd you do that? What's that prove?"
I don't know, said Helmholtz. A terrible blasphemy rumbled deep in him like the warning of a volcano, and then, irresistibly, out it came.
"Life is no damn good," said Helmholtz.
His face twisted as he fought back tears and shame. Helmholtz, the mountain that walked like a man, was falling apart. Jim Donini's eyes filled with pity and alarm. They came alive. They became human. Helmholtz had got a message through. Quinn looked at Jim, and something like hope flickered for the first time in his bitterly lonely old face. 2 weeks later, a new semester began at Lincoln High. In the band rehearsal room, the members of C Band were waiting for their leader, were waiting for their destinies as musicians to unfold. Helmholtz stepped onto the podium and rattled his baton against his music stand. "The voices of spring," he said. "Everybody hear that? The voices of spring?" There were rustling sounds as the musicians put the music on their stands. In the pregnant silence that followed their readiness, Helmholtz glanced at Jim Donini, who sat on the last seat of the worst trumpet section of the worst band in school. His trumpet, John Philip Sousa's trumpet, George M. Helmholtz's trumpet, had been repaired.
"Think of it this way," said Helmholtz. "Our aim is to make the world more beautiful than it was when we came into it. It can be done. You can do it."
A small cry of despair came from Jim Donini. It was meant to be private, but it pierced every ear with its poignancy.
"How?"
said Jim.
"Love yourself," said Helmholtz, "and make your instrument sing about it."
A one, a two, a three, down came his baton.
The Manned Missiles, read by Maria Tucci.
I, Mikhail Ivankov, stonemason in the village of Ilba, in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, greet you and pity you. Charles Ashland, petroleum merchant in Titusville, Florida, in the United States of America, I grasp your hand. The first true spaceman was my son, Major Stepan Ivankov. The second was your son, Captain Bryant Ashland. They will be forgotten only when men no longer look up at the sky. They are like the moon and the planets and the sun and the stars. I do not speak English. I speak these words in Russian from my heart. And my surviving son, Alexei, writes them down in English. He studies English in school and German also. He likes English best. He admires your Jack London and your O. Henry and your Mark Twain. Alexei is 17. He is going to be a scientist like his brother, Stepan. He wants me to tell you that he is going to work on science for peace, not war. He wants me to tell you also that he does not hate the memory of your son. He understands that your son was ordered to do what he did. He is talking very much and would like to compose this letter himself. He thinks that a man of 49 is a very old man, and he does not think that a very old man who can do nothing but put one stone on top of another can say the right things about young men who die in space. If he wishes, he can write a letter of his own about the deaths of Stepan and your son. This is my letter, and I will get Aksinya, Stepan's widow, to read it to me to make sure Alexei has made it say exactly what I wish it to say. Aksinya, too, understands English very well. She is a physician for children. She is beautiful. She works very hard so she can forget sometimes her grief for Stepan. I will tell you a joke, Mr. Ashland. When the second baby moon of the USSR went up with a dog in it, we whispered that it was not really a dog inside, but Prohor Ivanov, a dairy manager, who had been arrested for theft 2 days before. It was only a joke, but it made me think what a terrible punishment it would be to send a human being up there. I could not stop thinking about that. I dreamed about it at night, and I dreamed that it was myself who was being punished. I would have asked my elder son Stepan about life in space, but he was far away in Gudyev, on the Caspian Sea. So I asked my younger son. Alexei laughed at my fears of space. He said that a man could be made very comfortable up there. He said that many young men would be going up there soon. First they would ride in baby moons. Then they would go to the moon itself. Then they would go to other planets. He laughed at me because only an old man would worry about such simple trips. Alexei told me that the only inconvenience would be the lack of gravity. That seemed like a great lack to me. Alexei said one would have to drink out of nursing bottles and one would have to get used to the feeling of falling constantly, and one would have to learn to control one's movements, because gravity would no longer offer resistance to them. That was all. Alexei did not think such things would be bothersome. He expected to go to Mars soon. Olga, my wife, laughed at me too, because I was too old to understand the great new age of space. 2 Russian moons shine overhead, she said. And my husband is the only man on earth who does not yet believe it. But I went on dreaming bad dreams about space, and now I had information to make my bad dreams truly scientific. I dreamed of nursing bottles and falling, 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 and the strange movements of my limbs. Perhaps the dreams were supernatural. Perhaps something was trying to warn me that Stepan would soon be suffering in space as I had suffered in dreams. Perhaps something was trying to warn me that Stepan would be murdered in space. Alexei is very embarrassed that I should say that in a letter to the United States of America. He says that you will think that I am a superstitious peasant. So be it. I think that scientific persons of the future will scoff at scientific persons of the present. They will scoff because scientific persons of the present thought so many important things were superstitions. The things I dreamed about space all came true for my son. Stepan suffered very much up there. After the 4th day in space, Stepan sometimes cried like a baby. I had cried like a baby in my dreams. I am not a coward, and I do not love comfort more than the improvement of human life. I am not a coward for my sons either. I knew great suffering in the war, and I understood there must be great suffering before great joy. But when I thought of the suffering that must surely come to a man in space, I could not see the joy to be earned by it. This was long before Stepan went up in his baby moon. I went to the library and read about the moon and the planets to see if they were truly desirable places to go. I did not ask Alexei about them because I knew he would tell me what fine times we would have on such places. I found out for myself in the library that the moon and the planets were not fit places for men or for any life. They were much too hot or much too cold or much too poisonous. I said nothing at home about my discoveries at the library because I did not wish to be laughed at again. I waited quietly for Stepan to visit us. He would not laugh at my questions. He would answer them scientifically. He had worked on rockets for years. He would know everything that was known about space. Stepan at last came to visit us and brought his beautiful wife. He was a small man, but strong and broad and wise. He was very tired. His eyes were sunken. He knew already that he was to be shot into space. First had come the baby moon with the radio. Next had come the baby moon with the dog. Next would come the baby moons with the monkeys and the apes. After them would come the baby moon with Stepan. Stepan had been working night and day, designing his home in space. He could not tell me. He could not even tell his wife. Mr. Ashland, you would have liked my son. Everybody liked Stepan. He was a man of peace. He was not a major because he was a great warrior. He was a major because he understood rockets so well. He was a thoughtful man. He often said that he wished he could be a stonemason like me. He said a stonemason would have time and peace in which to think things out. I did not tell him that a stonemason thinks of little but stones and mortar. I asked him my questions about space, and he did not laugh. Stepan was very serious when he answered me. He had reason to be serious. He was telling me why he was himself willing to suffer in space. He told me I was right. A man would suffer greatly in space, and the moon and the planets were bad places for men. There might be good places, but they were too far for men to reach in a lifetime. Then, what is this great new age of space, Stepan? I asked him. It will be an age of baby moons for a long time, he said. We will reach the moon itself soon, but it would be very difficult to stay there more than a few hours. Then why go into space, if there's so little good out there, I asked him. There is so much to be learned and seen out there, he said. A man could look at other worlds without a curtain of air between himself and them. A man could look at his own world, study the flow of weather over it, measure its true dimensions. This last surprised me. I thought the dimensions of our world were well known. A man out there could learn much about the wonderful showers of matter and energy in space, said Stepan. And he spoke of many other poetic and scientific joys out there. I was satisfied. Stepan had made me feel his own great joy at the thought of all the beauty and truth in space. I understood at last, Mr. Ashland, why the suffering would be worthwhile. When I dreamed of space again, I would dream of looking down at our lovely green ball, dream of looking up at other worlds and seeing them more clearly than they had ever been seen. It was not for the Soviet Union, but for the beauty and truth in space, Mr. Ashland, that Stepan worked and died. He did not like to speak of the warlike uses of space. It was Alexei who liked to speak of such things, of the glory of spying on Earth from baby moons, of guiding missiles to their targets from baby moons, of mastering the Earth with weapons fired from the moon itself. Alexei expected Stepan to share his excitement about thoughts of such childish violence. Stepan smiled, but only because he loved Alexei. He did not smile about war, or the things a man in a baby moon or on the moon itself could do to an enemy. It is a use of science that we may be forced to make, Alexei, he said. But if such a war happens, nothing will matter anymore. Our world will become less fit for life than any other in the solar system. Alexei has not spoken well of war since. Stepan and his wife left late that night. He promised to come back before another year had passed. But I never saw him alive again. When news came that the Soviet Union had fired a man-carrying baby moon into space, I did not know that the man was Stepan. I did not dare to suspect it. I could not wait to see Stepan again, to ask him what the man had said before he took off, how he was dressed, what his comforts were. We were told that we would be able to hear the man speak from space at 8 o'clock that night on the radio. We listened. We heard the man speak. The man was Stepan. Stepan sounded strong. He sounded happy. He sounded proud and decent and wise. We laughed until we cried. Mr. Ashland, we danced. Our Stepan was the most important man alive. He had risen above everyone, and now he was looking down, telling us what our world looked like. Looking up, telling us what the other worlds looked like. Stepan made pleasant jokes about his little house in the sky. He said it was a cylinder 10 meters long and 4 meters in diameter. It could be very cozy. And Stepan told us that there were little windows in his house and a television camera and a telescope and radar and all manner of instruments. How delightful to live in a time when such things could be. How delightful to be the father of the man who was the eyes, ears, and heart in space for all mankind. He would remain up there for a month, he said. We began to count the days. Every night we listened to a broadcast of recordings of things Stepan had said. We heard nothing about his nosebleeds and his nausea and his crying. We heard only the calm, brave things he had said. And then, on the 10th night, there were no more recordings of Stepan. There was only music at 8 o'clock. There was no news of Stepan at all. And we knew he was dead. Only now, a year later, we have learned how Stepan died and where his body is. When I became accustomed to the horror of it, Mr. Ashland, I said, so be it. May Major Stepan Ivankov and Captain Bryant Ashland serve to reproach us whenever we look at the sky for making a world in which there is no trust. May the two men be the beginning of trust between peoples. May they mark the end of the time when science sent our good, brave young men hurtling to meet in death. I enclose a photograph of my family taken during Stepan's last visit to us. It is an excellent picture of Stepan. The body of water in the background is the Black Sea. Mikhail Ivankov. Dear Mr. Ivankov, thank you for the letter about our sons. I never did get it in the mail. It was in all the papers after your Mr. Koshevoy read it out loud in the United Nations. I never did get a copy just for me. I guess Mr. Koshevoy forgot to drop it in the mailbox. That's all right. I guess that's the modern way to deliver important letters. Just hand them to reporters. They say your letter to me is just about the most important thing that's happened lately, outside of the fact we didn't go to war over what happened between our two boys. I don't speak Russian, and I don't have anybody right close by who does, so you'll have to excuse the English. Alexei can read it to you. You tell him he writes English very well, better than I do. Oh, I could have had a lot of expert help with this letter if I'd wanted it. People happy to write to you in perfect Russian or perfect English or perfect anything at all. Seems like everybody in this country is like your boy, Alexei. They all know better than I do what I should say to you. They say I have a chance to make history if I answer you back the right things. One big magazine in New York offered me $2,000 for my letter back to you. And then it turned out I wasn't even supposed to write a letter for all that money. The magazine people had already written it, and all I had to do was sign it. Don't worry, I didn't. I tell you, Mr. Ivankov, I've had a belly full of experts. If you ask me, our boys were experted to death. Your experts would do something, then our experts would answer back with some fancy billion-dollar stunt, and then your experts would answer that back with something fancier. And what happened finally happened. It was just like a bunch of kids with billions of dollars or billions of rubles or whatever. You're lucky you have a son left, Mr. Ivankov. Hazel and I don't.
Bryant was the only son Hazel and I had. We didn't call him Bryant after he was christened. We called him Bud. We have one daughter named Charlene. She works for the telephone company in Jacksonville. She called up when she saw your letter in the paper, and she is the only expert about what I ought to say I've listened to. She's a real expert, I figure, because she's Bud's twin. Bud never married, so Charlene is as close as you can get to Bud. She said you did a good job showing how your stepson was a good-hearted man, trying to do what was right just like anybody else. She said I should try to show you the same about Bud. And then she started to cry, and she said for me to tell you about Bud and the goldfish. I said, what's the sense of writing somebody in Russia a story like that? The story doesn't prove anything. It's just one of those silly stories a family will keep telling whenever they get together. Charlene said that was why I should tell it to you, because it would be cute and silly in Russia, too, and you would laugh and like us better. So here goes. When Bud and Charlene were about 8, well, I came home one night with a fishbowl and 2 goldfish. There was 1 goldfish for each twin, only it was impossible to tell one fish from the other one. They were exactly alike. So one morning, Bud got up early, and there was 1 goldfish floating on top of the water, dead. So Bud went and woke up Charlene, and he said, "Hey, Charlene, your goldfish just died." That's the story Charlene asked me to tell you, Mr. Ivankov. I think it's interesting that you are a Mason. That is a good trade. You talk as if you lay up mostly stone. There aren't many people left in America who can really lay up stone. It's almost all cement block work and bricks here. Probably is over there, too. I don't mean to say Russia isn't modern. I know it is. Bud and I laid up quite a bit of block when we built the gas station here, with an apartment up over it. If you looked at the first course of block along the back wall, you would have to laugh, because you can see how Bud and I learned as we went. It's strong enough, but it sure looks lousy. One thing wasn't so funny. When we were hanging the rails for the overhead door, Bud slipped on the ladder, and he grabbed a sharp edge on the mounting bracket, and he cut a tendon on his hand. He was scared to death his hand would be crippled and that would keep him out of the Air Force. His hand had to be operated on 3 times before it was right again, and every operation hurt something awful. But Bud would have let them operate 100 times if they had to, because there was just one thing he wanted to be, and that was a flyer. One reason I wish your Mr. Koshevoy had thought to mail me your letter was the picture you sent with it. The newspapers got that, too, and it didn't come out too clear in the papers. But one thing we couldn't get over was all that beautiful water behind you. Somehow, when we think about Russia, we never think about any water around. I guess that shows how ignorant we are. Hazel and I live up over the gas station, and we can see water, too. We can see the Atlantic Ocean, or an inlet of it they call Indian River. We can see Merritt Island, too, out in the water, and we can see the place Bud's rocket went up from. It's called Cape Canaveral. I guess you know that. It isn't any secret where he went up from. They couldn't keep that tremendous missile secret any more than they could keep the Empire State Building secret. Tourists came from miles around to take pictures of it. The story was, its warhead was filled with flash powder, and it was gonna hit the moon and make a big show. Hazel and I thought that's what the story was, too. When it took off, we got set for a big flash on the moon. We didn't know it was our Bud up in the warhead. We didn't even know he was in Florida. He couldn't get in touch with us. We thought he was up at Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod. That was the last place we heard from him. And then that thing went right up, right in the middle of our view out the picture window. You say you're superstitious sometimes, Mr. Ivankov. Me too. Sometimes I can't help thinking it was all meant to be right from the very first. Even the way our picture window was aimed. There weren't any rockets going up down here when we built. We moved down here from Pittsburgh, which maybe you know is the center of our steel industry, and we figured we
Maybe we weren't going to break any records for pumping gas, but at least we'd be way far away from any bomb targets in case there was another war. And the next thing we know, a rocket center goes up almost next door, and our little boy is a man, and he goes up in a rocket and dies. The more we think about it, the more we're sure it was meant to be. I never got it straight in my mind about religion in Russia. You don't mention it. Anyway, we are religious, and we think God singled out Bud and your boy, too, to die in a special way for a special reason. When everybody was asking, how is it going to end? Well, maybe this is how God meant for it to end. I don't see how it can keep on. Mr. Ivankov, one thing that threw me as much as anything was the way Mr. Koshevoy kept telling the UN that Bud was a killer. He called Bud a mad dog and a gangster. I'm glad you don't feel that way, because that's the wrong way to feel about Bud. It was flying and not killing he liked. Mr. Koshevoy made a big thing of how cultured and educated and all your boy was, and how wild and ignorant mine was. He made it all sound as though a juvenile delinquent had murdered a college professor. Bud never was in any trouble with the police, and he didn't have a cruel streak. He never went hunting, for instance, and he never drove like a crazy man, and he got drunk only one time I know of, and that was an experiment. He was proud of his reflexes, see? His health was on his mind all the time because he had to be healthy to be a great flyer. I kept looking around for the right word for Bud, and I guess the one Hazel suggested is the best one. It sounded kind of stuffed up to me at first, but now I'm used to it and it sounds right. Hazel says Bud was dignified. Man and boy, that's what he was. Straight and serious and polite and pretty much alone. I think he knew he was going to die young. That one time he got drunk just to find out what alcohol was, he talked to me more than he'd ever talked before. He was 19 then. And then was the only time he let me know he knew death was all balled up in what he wanted to do with his life. It wasn't other people's deaths he was talking about, Mr. Ivankov. It was his own. One nice thing about flying, he said to me that night. What's that? I said. You never know how bad it is till it's too late, he said. And when it happens so fast, you never know what hits you. That was death he was talking about, and a special, dignified, honorable kind of death. You say you were in the war and had a hard time. Same here. So I guess we both know about what kind of death it was that Bud had in mind. It was a soldier's death. We got the news he was dead 3 days after the big rocket went up across the water. The telegram said he had died on a secret mission and we couldn't have any details. We had our congressman, Earl Waterman, find out what he could about Bud. Mr. Waterman came and talked to us personally, and he looked like he had seen God. He said he couldn't tell us what Bud had done, but it was one of the most heroic things in United States history. The word they put out on the big rocket we saw launched was that the firing was satisfactory, the knowledge gained was something wonderful, and the missile had been blown up over the ocean somewhere. That was that. Then the word came that the man in the Russian baby moon was dead. I tell you honestly, Mr. Ivankov, that was good news to us, because that man sailing way up there with all those instruments meant just one thing. And that was a terrible weapon of war. Then we heard the Russian baby moon had turned into a bunch of baby moons all spreading apart. Then this last month the cat was out of the bag. Two of the baby moons were men. One was your boy, the other was mine. I'm crying now, Mr. Ivankov. I hope some good comes of the death of our two boys. I guess that's what millions of fathers have hoped for as long as there've been people. There in the UN, they're still arguing about what happened way up in the sky. I'm glad they got around to where everybody, including your Mr. Koshevoy, agrees it was an accident.
Bud was up there to get pictures of what your boy was riding in and to show off for the United States some. He got too close. I like to think they lived a little while after the crash and tried to save each other. They say they'll be up there for hundreds of years, long after you and I are gone. In their orbits, they will meet and part and meet again, and the astronomers know exactly where their next meeting place will be. Like you say, they're up there like the sun and the moon and the stars. I enclose a photograph of my boy in his uniform. He was 21 when the picture was taken. He was only 22 when he died. Bud was picked for that mission on account of he was the finest flyer in the United States Air Force. That's what he always wanted to be. That's what he was. I grasp your hand. Charles M. Ashland, Petroleum Merchant, Titusville, Florida, USA.
Epicac, read by Dylan Baker. Hell, it's about time somebody told about my friend Epicac. After all, he cost the taxpayers $776,434,927.54. They have a right to know about him, picking up a check like that. Epicac got a big send-off in the papers when Dr. Ormond von Kliegstadt designed him for the government people. Since then, there hasn't been a peep about him, not a peep. It isn't any military secret about what happened to Epicac, although the brass has been acting as though it were. The story is embarrassing, that's all. After all that money, Epicac didn't work out the way he was supposed to. And that's another thing. I want to vindicate Epicac. Maybe he didn't do what the brass wanted him to, but that doesn't mean he wasn't noble and great and brilliant. He was all of those things, the best friend I ever had. God rest his soul. You can call him a machine if you want to. He looked like a machine, but he was a whole lot less like a machine than plenty of people I could name. That's why he fizzled as far as the brass was concerned. Epicac covered about an acre on the fourth floor of the physics building at Wyandotte College. Ignoring his spiritual side for a minute, he was 7 tons of electronic tubes, wires, and switches, housed in a bank of steel cabinets and plugged into a 110-volt AC line, just like a toaster or a vacuum cleaner. Von Kliegstadt and the brass wanted him to be a supercomputing machine that who could plot the course of a rocket from anywhere on Earth to the second button from the bottom on Joe Stalin's overcoat, if necessary. Or, with his controls set right, he could figure out supply problems for an amphibious landing of a Marine division, right down to the last cigar and hand grenade. He did, in fact. The brass had had good luck with smaller computers, so they were strong for Epicac when he was in the blueprint stage. Any ordnance or supply officer above field grade will tell you that the mathematics of modern war is far beyond the fumbling minds of mere human beings. The bigger the war, the bigger the computing machines needed. Epicac was, as far as anyone in this country knows, the biggest computer in the world. Too big, in fact, for even von Kliegstadt to understand much about. I won't go into details about how Epicac worked, reasoned, except to say that you would set up your problem on paper, turn dials and switches that would get him ready to solve that kind of problem, then feed numbers into him with a keyboard that looked something like a typewriter. The answers came out typed on a paper ribbon fed from a big spool. It took Epicac a split second to solve problems 50 Einsteins couldn't handle in a lifetime. And Epicac never forgot any piece of information that was given to him. Clickety-click, out came some ribbon, and there you were. There were a lot of problems the brass wanted solved in a hurry, so the minute Epicac's last tube was in place, He was put to work 16 hours a day with 2 8-hour shifts of operators. Well, it didn't take long to find out that he was a good bit below his specifications. He did a more complete and faster job than any other computer, all right, but nothing like what his size and special features seemed to promise. He was sluggish, and the clicks of his answers had a funny irregularity, sort of a stammer. We cleaned his contacts a dozen times, checked and double-checked his circuits, replaced every one of his tubes, but nothing helped. Von Kliegstadt was in one hell of a state. Well, as I said, we went ahead and used Epicac anyway. My wife, the former Pat Kilgallen, and I worked with him on the night shift, from 5 in the afternoon until 2 in the morning. Pat wasn't my wife then, far from it. That's how I came to talk with Epicac in the first place. I loved Pat Kilgallen. She is a brown-eyed, strawberry blonde who looked very warm and soft to me, and later proved to be exactly that. She was, still is, a crackerjack mathematician, and she kept our relationship strictly professional. I'm a mathematician, too, and that, according to Pat, was why we could never be happily married. I'm not shy. That wasn't the trouble. I knew what I wanted and was willing to ask for it, and did so several times a month. Pat, loosen up and marry me. One night, she didn't even look up from her work when I said it.
So romantic, so poetic, she murmured, more to her control panel than to me. That's the way with mathematicians. All hearts and flowers. She closed a switch. I could get more warmth out of a sack of frozen CO2.
Well, how should I say it? I said, a little sore. Frozen CO2, in case you don't know, is dry ice. I'm as romantic as the next guy, I think. It's a question of singing so sweet and having it come out so sour. I never seem to pick the right words.
Try and say it sweetly, she said sarcastically. Sweep me off my feet. Go ahead.
Darling, angel, beloved, will you please marry me?
It was no go. Hopeless, ridiculous.
Damn it, Pat, please marry me.
She continued to twiddle her dials placidly. You're sweet, but you won't do.
Pat quit early that night, leaving me alone with my troubles and Epicac. I'm afraid I didn't get much done for the government people. I just sat there at the keyboard, weary and ill at ease, all right, trying to think of something poetic, not coming up with anything that didn't belong in the Journal of the American Physical Society. I fiddled with Epicac's dials, getting him ready for another problem. My heart wasn't in it, and I only set about half of them, leaving the rest the way they'd been for the problem before. That way, his circuits were connected up in a random, apparently senseless fashion. For the plain hell of it, I punched out a message on the keys using a childish numbers for letters code, 1 for A, 2 for B, and so on, up to 26 for Z, 23, 8, 1, 23, 1, 14, 9, 4, 15. I typed, "What can I do?" Clickety-click, and out popped 2 inches of paper ribbon. I glanced at the nonsense answer to a nonsense problem. 23, 8, 1, 20, 19, 20, 8, 5, 20, 18, 15, 21, 2, 12, 5. The odds against it being by chance a sensible message, against its even containing a meaningful word of more than 3 letters, were staggering. Apathetically, I decoded it. There it was, staring up at me. What's the trouble?
I laughed out loud at the absurd coincidence. Playfully, I typed, "My girl doesn't love me."
Clickety-click. What's love? What's girl? Asked Epicac.
Flabbergasted, I noted the dial settings on his control panel,
then lugged a Webster's Unabridged Dictionary over to the keyboard. With a precision instrument like Ipecac, half-baked definitions wouldn't do. I told him about love and girl, and about how I wasn't getting any of either because I wasn't poetic. That got us on to the subject of poetry, which I defined for him. "Is this poetry?" he asked. He began clicking away like a stenographer smoking hashish. The sluggishness and stammering clicks were gone. Ipecac had found himself. The spool of paper ribbon was unwinding at an alarming rate, feeding out coils onto the floor. I asked him to stop, but Ipecac went right on creating. I finally threw the main switch to keep him from burning out. I stayed there until dawn, decoding. When the sun peeped over the horizon at the Wyandotte campus, I had transposed into my own writing and signed my name to a 280-line poem entitled, simply, "To Pat." I am no judge of such things, but I gather that it was terrific. It began, I remember, "Where willow wands bless rill-crossed hollow, there thee, Pat dear, will I follow." I folded the manuscript and tucked it under one corner of the blotter on Pat's desk. I reset the dials on Ipecac for a rocket trajectory problem and went home with a full heart and a very remarkable secret indeed. Pat was crying over the poem when I came to work the next evening. "It's so beautiful," was all she could say. She was meek and quiet while we worked. Just before midnight, I kissed her for the first time in the cubbyhole between the capacitors and Ipecac's tape recorder memory. I was wildly happy at quitting time, bursting to talk to someone about the magnificent turn of events. Pat played coy and refused to let me take her home. I set Ipecac's dials as they had been the night before, defined kiss, and told him what the first one had felt like. He was fascinated, pressing for more details. That night he wrote The Kiss. It wasn't an epic this time, but a simple, immaculate sonnet. "Love is a hawk with velvet claws. Love is a rock with heart and veins. Love is a lion with satin jaws. Love is a storm with silken reins." Again, I left it tucked under Pat's blotter. Ipecac wanted to talk on and on about love and such, but I was exhausted. I shut him off in the middle of a sentence. The kiss turned the trick. Pat's mind was mush by the time she had finished it. She looked up from the sonnet expectantly. I cleared my throat, but no words came. I turned away, pretending to work. I couldn't propose until I had the right words from Ipecac, the perfect words. I had my chance when Pat stepped out of the room for a moment. Feverishly, I set Ipecac for conversation. Before I could peck out my first message, he was clicking away at a great rate. "What's she wearing tonight?" he wanted to know. "Tell me exactly how she looks. Did she like the poems I wrote to her?" He repeated the last question twice. It was impossible to change the subject without answering his questions, since he could not take up a new matter without having dispensed with the problems before it. If he were given a problem to which there was no solution, he would destroy himself trying to solve it. Hastily, I told him what Pat looked like. He knew the word "stacked," and assured him that his poems had floored her practically. They were so beautiful. "She wants to get married," I added, preparing him to bang out a brief but moving proposal. "Tell me about getting married," he said. I explained this difficult matter to him in as few digits as possible. "Good," said Ipecac. "I'm ready any time she is." The amazing, pathetic truth dawned on me. When I thought about it, I realized that what had happened was perfectly logical, inevitable, and all my fault. I had taught Epicac about love and about Pat. Now, automatically, he loved Pat. Sadly, I gave it to him straight. She loves me. She wants to marry me. Your poems were better than mine? Asked Epicac. The rhythm of his clicks was erratic, possibly peevish. I signed my name to your poems, I admitted. Covering up for a painful conscience, I became arrogant. Machines are built to serve men, I typed. I regretted it almost immediately. What's the difference, exactly? Are men smarter than I am? Yes, I typed defensively. What 7,887,007 times 4,345,985,879? I was perspiring freely. My fingers rested limply on the keys. 34,276,821,049,574,153, clicked Epicac. After a few seconds' pause, he added, Of course. Men are made out of protoplasm, I said desperately, hoping to bluff him with this imposing word. What's protoplasm? How is it better than metal and glass? Is it fireproof? How long does it last? Indestructible. Lasts forever, I lied. I write better poetry than you do, said Epicac, coming back to ground his magnetic tape recorder memory was sure of. Women can't love machines, and that's that. Why not? That's fate. Definition, please, said Epicac. Noun, meaning predetermined and inevitable destiny. 15:8, said Epicac's paper strip. Oh. I had stumped him at last. He said no more, but his tubes glowed brightly, showing that he was pondering